Well, for the sermon today, my goal is, well, hopefully, my goal is to encourage. That's my goal, is to encourage. And actually to get us to stop and kind of consider some things that we may not normally stop and consider. What we're going to discuss today is something that we all need to have in the forefront of our minds, especially as we go forward in our day-to-day lives. And as Mr. Ford mentioned, you know, that kind of wilderness period in between the last great day and the Passover beginning, the spring holy days beginning. You know, it's always nice to have something to keep in our minds and focused, and I appreciated his sermonette, and because that in itself is very encouraging. We do have places to go. We have God's Word that we can go to battle against the wiles of the devil, to battle against and to help us as we go forward in this wilderness. I appreciated that very much. But we do need things to help, if you will, either encourage us, to remind us, to prod us, to help bring to, I guess you could say, a refocused mindset, to help us to recalibrate and help us as we go through this journey. So I've got a little video that I want to begin with, and I've got to plug it in here, so hopefully this will pull up. There's really no sound to it. It had some music. That's okay. You don't need to hear it. So just this video. It does have some captions on the top, so you can... This is actually an Adam. It says it up there. I'm sorry. I show that video. It's to me, it's quite intriguing. I'm sorry that all the words, the captions were up on the top. If you were standing on your head, you could probably have seen it. But I had it pushed too far backwards, so I'm sorry about that. But this video is actually trying to explain the theory of microism and macroism. And microism and macroism are actually two aspects of a theory that historians say were developed by the ancient Greeks. The ancient Greek philosophers actually describe humans and their place and their connection with the universe. But just even looking at this video, you see that there is very quite similar, there's similarities. As you go out, if you will, into the galaxies, or out of the galaxy, and see the multiple galaxies and the way that it's kind of set up. They can see far out, but they really can't put it all together. They haven't been able to do that as of yet. But what is really neat is if they have been able to go in and see all the things. Like, for instance, this was just in the eye, going into the eye and seeing just the makeup of the human cell, like the white blood cell, and going in to see the chromosomes and the DNA and the atom and all that it consists of. And it's really interesting to see that there is, as they say, a connection with the universe. There's actually much said about this particular theory, which we're not going to go into today. But simply put, and I guess the easiest explanation of microism and macroism is this. It refers to any smaller system that is representative of a larger system, and I guess you could say vice versa. For instance, the complexity of the human body and the representation of the complexity of the universe, because they say they share common attributes. I feel like that in itself is quite amazing. If you want to define microism, it's this. Human beings, humanity or society, regarded as encapsulating in miniature the characteristic qualities or features of something larger, just as you saw with the eye. That's what they were trying to explain, that a human being just in the eye itself, and they didn't go into anything else, into any other part of the body, but it encapsulates in miniature the characteristic qualities or features of something much larger, because as microism, its definition is the great world or universe, is how it is put, and it is a representation of a smaller unit or entity by a larger one. This theory has actually grown differing legs throughout the years, and has actually been used in pagan idolatry. As you can imagine, they twist anything to be used for idolatry. But that's not what I want to focus on today, or even talk about. But this video was only shown to bring about a point, to bring out a point, and hopefully I'll be able to, if you will, put a dot on that and help you to understand where I'm trying to go. What I do want to focus on today is how we as human beings, and especially those of us God has called, encapsulate in miniature. We encapsulate in miniature the characteristic qualities, if you will, or features of something much larger. We do. And I would ask that you keep that in mind as we go throughout the message today. Because that's quite important. Because we, especially us that are called, we encapsulate, and I want to say in miniature, the characteristic qualities or features of something much larger. So to begin today, I'd actually like to share with you some thoughts. And that's always a dangerous thing whenever I share thoughts. But it's thoughts that I have whenever I'm walking in the mornings. I guess you could tag it walking thoughts. but how many of you in here think and walk at the same time? See, there you go. Mostly everybody. That's good. Otherwise, you trip and fall. I actually have deep thoughts. Ooh, that's scary. Deep thoughts. But where we live, we have a nice area that has a walking trail. It's not too far away from the house that I like to walk at. And I usually walk about 4 miles of this trail. And as you walk through these 4 miles of this trail, there's many different things to see. It's a very beautiful trail. It's through the woods. It actually has two bridges that cross the creek, and it has many different things, like geese. I have to run them out of the trail sometimes because they're out in the middle of the trail. Then there's deer. The deer will stand. I guess they're just used to people being there. The deer will stand there and just watch you as you walk past. And then, of course, there's fish. You can see, well, not right now. They're kind of in the deeper water. But the bald eagle. There's a couple bald eagles, and it's wonderful as I'm walking. You'll see it kind of swoop down, and he's just looking for something to get a hold of, get his talons in. He's looking for something to eat. But there's always something to see. But on Thursday of this week, I was walking early in the morning, and it was snowing, which wasn't forecasted, by the way. They're pretty good about not forecasting things we get. But it snowed the entire time I was walking. It was actually supposed to be a sunny day, but it was snowing. And it was snowing pretty, not heavy, but it was just light enough to where it was, it's very pleasant, actually, to be in it. But it was cold. There was ice. It was very cold. I think it was 19 degrees, 20 degrees. It doesn't matter. Somewhere right in there. But I had my gloves on, my hat on, and I was walking at a pretty swift pace to keep myself warm. But it's times like that, whenever the snow is falling and such, that I like to reflect on, that I have certain reflections on certain things. For instance, I mean, you know, I was right in the middle of it. I started thinking about the snow and the ice and the cold. I started thinking about that. I began to think about how and why God created the things the way he did. Just something that kind of came to mind as I was walking. And anyway, because it was, like I said, it was snowing and it was cold and there was ice here and there, so I just began thinking about that. And as I walked, I've been looking into the book of Job, and as I was walking, Job came to mind, the book of Job, and because we read in the book of Job, we actually read of a mindset that both Job and his friends, the attitude that they had and the mindset they were in prior to the young man, if you read Job, they had this particular mindset. They had his friends had a particular mindset about Job, and Job had a particular mindset about them, and you had this young man, Elihu, that was sitting there listening to it all. And then it became, whenever there was silence and Elihu had the opportunity, he then spoke. He says, "I was young, and I, you know, felt like I appreciate his words. It's almost, I felt like I was less wise than you." But then he goes and he begins to explain wisdom to them. But anyway, Elihu, he begins this discourse with them, he condemning, if you will, the older men's self-righteousness. That's what it was, the older men's self-righteousness. And in turn, he began proclaiming God's goodness and God's power and his majesty. He began explaining that to them. Then I want to go to Job, and I want to open it up to Job 38. Because then, after Elihu gets done, God enters the picture to talk to Job, to answer, if you will, Job. Because Job's been asking for this. If only I could talk to God, I could state my case. And as his friends would say, "Well, you're not worthy to, because apparently you've sinned and God ain't gonna talk to you." And that's pretty much what they said, if you just want to put it in layman's terms. But in Job 38, God reveals himself to Job, and he reveals himself not only to Job, but his friends. And God begins, the Lord answered in verse 1 of Job 38, he answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" And that was interesting right there, because here God called him a righteous man, and to be able to be tagged a righteous man, he had to have knowledge of God, but he didn't have proper knowledge of God. Because, as he says, "Now prepare yourself like a man, and I will question you, and you shall answer me." And then so God goes into the creation. He says, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me, Job, if you have understanding." And God wasn't being sarcastic. He was being direct. "Tell me, Job, if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know, because you've made it be known that you're on the same level as God, to be able to stand there and say, hey, we're going to have a conversation, if God would only talk to me." So God says, "Okay, we will." He says, "Or who stretched the line upon it?" He begins by asking these questions, relevant questions, very relevant questions to a physical human being. "To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God," as I like how he puts that, "all the sons of God shouted for joy." And the question, I imagine, came up, no doubt, "Where were you Or who shut in the sea with the doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb when I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band? When I fixed my limit, he says, and set bars and doors, and I said to the sea, that this far you may come, but no further. And here your proud waves, they must stop. Have you commanded the morning since your days began, Job, and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? He says, have you entered the springs of the sea, or have you walked in the search of the depths? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. As he continues on, he asks Job all of these questions. And one area that this is what I began thinking about as I was walking in verse 22. He says, have you entered the treasury of snow? Have you seen the treasury of hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? He says, by what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth? Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolt? To cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness in which there is no man. To satisfy the desolate waste and cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass. Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven? Who gives it its birth? The waters harden like stone and the surface of the deep is frozen. I just want to stop there. Because as I was walking, I began thinking about these things. And I began thinking about how God asked Job, you know, where were you? How did all these things come about? Well, when you stop and you consider it, all of these things, the ice, the snow, and for instance, the tender grass, the way that the path of the thunderbolt, the father of the rain, who's begotten the drops of dew, where did it all come from? That's what he wanted Job to stop and consider. And there was a reason he wanted us to stop and consider that. And as I was walking, I began thinking, like I said, about these very things. And this one passage came to mind, where it talks about from whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven, who gives its birth. The waters harden like stone and the surface of the deep is frozen. You know, like I said, I began thinking about ice. Why ice? Well, for one, it was on the ground. I could see it. But at the same time, I began thinking, you know, why does water freeze when it gets to 32 degrees Fahrenheit? And you could say, well, there's scientific reasoning for that, Nathan. Yes, absolutely. There is scientific reasoning for that. I understand that. I've learned that. Many of us have learned why water turns to a solid. We understand that when the water molecules get cold, they slow down. And they start attaching themselves to each other. And guess what happens? It forms a solid. But why is it that way? Why is it that way? Because God created it that way. He made it that way. You know, he made it beautiful to look at. You think about the frost this morning, the frost. I even hated to start up the car because the way the frost was standing on end on my windshield. And it had all these ice crystals all over the windshield. It was beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I mean, you think about the ice on the trees whenever you have a freezing rain. And whenever the sun comes out the next day and the sun glistens through all that ice, it refracts the light. And you get all these beautiful prismic colors. It's absolutely beautiful. Or a frozen waterfall. It's just absolutely beautiful. Ice crystals and icicles. I think we've all taken a piece of ice off of something and when we were a kid, at least. I know that I did. Grab an icicle and suck on it. You'd always try to see if it'd stick to your tongue first. But that's beside the point. Maybe I still do that. But anyway, moving on. But he didn't have to do it that way. He just didn't. But that's how he's done it. He did it that way. What about the snowflakes? You know, I was thinking about this because the snow was falling. And each one is unique. That's what I began thinking about. And as I'm looking at all this snowfall, I'm thinking to myself, every one of these are different. Every one of them. Have you ever taken time to look at a snowflake? Any of you? Have you ever said, you know, I can find one that matches? You just can't. It's impossible. It's absolutely impossible. Sometimes they're little pellets, but most of the time, I know that they can be also be sleet, but sometimes they combine together. They froze and refroze on their way down. But most of the time, they're beautiful. They're beautiful flakes. There's so many. They're so different. You know, why the formation? Why the shapes? Why did it? Why? Because that's the way God wanted it. That's the way He created it. It shows a lot about God when you start thinking about these things. It shows who God, what God's like, and what He's all about. Because He didn't have to do it this way, but He did. You know, we could go on, we could discuss the rest of God's creation. We've talked about ice and snow, because we've seen a lot of it as late. Ice and snow. We could talk about so many different things, the flowers, the trees, and the variety of the flowers and the trees. I mean, God could have created tulips. My wife would have been happy. That's your favorite flower. Yours too. All right. Tulip ladies. Tulip lady. Anyway. Tulip lady. Anyway, sorry. But he could have just made tulips, red tulips, and that's it. Do you think we would have gotten tired of red tulips? Maybe, maybe not. But God says, no. I want to show you what I'm like. Trees, all the different kinds of trees. Tall trees, short trees, evergreen trees. Trees that bloom in the spring. Trees that bloom in the fall. All different types of trees. Absolutely beautiful trees. Trees that produce fruit. Trees that produce nuts, which is type, if you will, I guess kind of a fruit. But at the same time, all these different things. The different birds. I mean, I look out of the bird feeder and I see all these different birds that come in. All different kinds. And this is just in Indiana. Southern Indiana. All the different birds throughout the world. Think about the different animals, all the different varieties of animals and the way they act and what they do. It's interesting when you stop and you consider all that, the oceans and their grandeur. I mean, just it's absolutely spectacular. And what's underneath the ocean? I remember when we were in Hawaii for the feast, we did some snorkeling. The beauty under the water, absolutely beautiful. The different colors of the fish, the different types of fish. Spiny fish, little fish, bright fish. Ugly fish. Just all kinds. Think about just the blue sky, looking up at it. I mean, just, and then the sun and the moon and the stars. I know when we were I'll mention Hawaii again, up on Mauna Kea, we had that opportunity to go up to 13,900 feet and watch the sunset, and then go down. The clouds were at 7,000 feet. We were down about 9,800, and we got to see the stars come out. We had the opportunity. You could see, I've never seen so many stars in my life. Saw the Milky Way. It was just absolutely beautiful. But all of it, there's such variety. So much variety. If you look on the Hubble, on NASA, and you go to Hubble Telescope, you can see the different shots the Hubble Telescope has taken. Now they've got a new one up there that's supposed to take even better pictures further out. And I'm excited to see some of those pictures that come out. But you can see all the different stars. Everything's different. The galaxies. So much variety. So when God had his discourse with Job, Job began to see something. He began to see something. What Job saw is what God wants us to see on a day-to-day basis. Because what God began with was his creation with Job. And if you talk, you go and you look at what everything that God spoke about, it was why things are the way they are. Tell me, Job, if you know. What Job saw is what God wants us to see and should be in the forefront of our minds as we go forward. And this is what we're going to discuss for the remainder of the message. And I want to pick it up in Job 42, verse 1. Job 42, verse 1. This is dangerous. I don't have my timer up here, and I didn't start it. I don't even know how long I've been up here. Sorry, guys. I'll be done when I'm done today. So, Job 42, verse 1. Then Job answered the Lord after God was finished. talking to him, he says, this is Job's words. This is very important to understand. He says, I know that you can do, this is Job talking to God, I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. Nothing. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, he says, I have uttered what I did not understand. Things too wonderful for me which I did not know. And then he tells God, listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you and you shall answer me. He says, I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. I fully see. Not fully, but I see what you're trying to get me to understand. And he goes on to say in verse 6, this mindset now that he has, therefore I abhor myself and I repent in dust and ashes. What was it that Job saw? Job came to see the greatness of God. That's what Job came to see, the greatness of God. And if you want a title for the sermon today, it's The Greatness of God. How, what, and why. The greatness of God. How, what, and why. And as we go through this today, I will literally scratch the surface. I'll probably scratch the scratch of the surface of the greatness of God. I mean, there's so much to go over. There is so much to pull out. I'm going to say the whole Bible. To understand and to see the greatness of God. And after we're done, if you're done reading the Bible, we still don't fully grasp the greatness of God. Like I said, the title is The Greatness of God, How, What, and Why. We're going to look at how His greatness is revealed, what we are to learn from it, why it matters. And, you know, in regards to this, this message is for those God has called or He is calling. And it is hopefully going to be a review, no doubt. It will be a review, but hopefully it'll be a reminder that is encouraging. Hopefully encouraging. So what is greatness? Well, dictionary.com, a physical definition of greatness here. The quality or state of being important, notable, or distinguished. The quality or state of being powerful or intense. The quality or state of being large in size and stature, number, etc. So how is greatness revealed? How is God's greatness revealed? Well, we've already touched on it a little bit. We've already kind of looked at that. But I want to go to Romans 1. Romans 1. We're going to look into Scripture and prove this. Romans 1. We're going to turn to actually a few passages today, quite a few. Romans 1 and verse 18. Romans 1 verse 18. Here we're told, Paul says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. They know better because He has shown it to them. How has He shown it to them? Verse 24, since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen. His invisible attributes, what He is about, His greatness, not in full display, but His greatness is clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. Even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. The invisible things of God, what He is capable of, His greatness. That's what that means. The invisible things of God, what He's capable of, His greatness. That word Godhead in the Greek is theotes, theotes, T-H-E-I-O-T-E-S. And it means divine nature. It says, those things, His invisible attributes, are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. Even His eternal power and Godhead, His divine nature, is understood. At least, it's seen. It's clearly revealed in what? His creation. As it says it right here, it's clearly revealed revealed in his creation. And what is his creation? We know what his creation is, right? Well, Psalm 33 just kind of puts a point on it. Psalm 33. Psalm 33 and verse 6. Psalm 33, verse 6, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made. You can go to Genesis 1 and you can look through that. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the host of them, by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays up the deep in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him, for he spoke and it was done. He commanded and it happened. God created everything. This is what his creation is. Everything. From the fragile snowflake to the galaxies far, far away. To the atom that is within us. To all the little quirks and everything else. I think that's where our quirkiness comes from. Anyway, I'm just kidding. Yeah, anyway, all the quirks. To the far, far away galaxies. God created it all. When we stop and consider the creation all around us, we need to stop and contemplate who has created all these things. We need to then stop and look a little harder. We need to stop and we need to contemplate. We need to consider. We need to look a little harder and a little longer at the majesty that surrounds us. Physically. Because it shows us what God is spiritually. You know, when we see the snow, what do we see? Do we just see white? Or do we see pretty? Is that what we see? Do we see a day off from school, day off from work, snow day? Or do we stop and consider the perplexity of each flake? Each and every flake and the multitude of them. You know, when it was snowing and I was walking on Thursday, my mind went straight, and I do this probably too many times, went straight to calculating the amount of snowflakes falling in that given area. That's just me. That's the way my mind works. I could see as far as the next half-mile marker. That's what I could see. I could see that far. So I began wondering to myself, how many snowflakes would fall in a half-mile cubic area? That's a lot of space. So as I was walking, I broke it up into 10-foot squares, 10-foot cubes. It's the easiest way to start. And there's what, 2,640 feet in a half mile. So I started thinking, well, if you divide that by 2,640, 10 foot by 2,640, it gives you 264 10-foot cubes. And I roughly, and I want to say conservatively, thought there could be, 100 snowflakes in that 10 by 10 cube. I thought that was pretty. Because I was looking at it, trying to count them. It's hard to count them. But I was thinking, you know, there's got to be at least 100. So that means in a half mile by 10 foot wide and 10 foot tall, you would have, when I found this interesting, there would be, that means at a half mile, 10 foot wide and 10 foot tall, there would be 26,400 flakes just in that one strip. And like I just said, a half mile cube, right? Well, you times it up a half mile, 10 foot wide, half mile long, you would have in that 10 by half mile, 6,969,600 flakes, if you had 100 flakes in each one of those, 10 foot by 10 foot cubes. Now multiply that by 264, because you've got to go a half mile that way. That means in a half mile by half mile cube, there will be 1,839,974,400 flakes in that cube. That's just in a half mile. That's a lot of snowflakes falling at one time. And I might add, only in a half mile. And I might add, they're all different. Each and every one of them. something to consider. What do we see when we see a snowflake? When we see the stars, what do we see? Do we just see lights in the skies? Oh, isn't that pretty? Or do we ponder further? They say that in our galaxy alone, this is actually from space.com in an article titled "How Many Stars Are in the Universe?" by Elizabeth Howe, May 17th, 2017. They say that in our galaxy alone, there are 100 billion stars in our Milky Way galaxy. 100 billion stars. Scientists don't know exactly, but there are estimates. I found this interesting. There are estimates that there could be as many as 10 trillion galaxies. Whew. 10 trillion galaxies. 10 trillion. If you were to take that 100 billion estimate of our galaxy and times it by the amount of possible galaxies in the universe, that would be one septillion stars in the universe. That is a one followed by 24 zeros. To put that in perspective, they say there are more stars in the universe than all the grains of the sand on this earth. That's a lot of sand. What did God tell Abraham? "I will make your descendants as the sand by the sea, stars in the heavens." So now I ask, what do we see? What do we see, or what should we see when we look up at night to a cloudless sky? What should we see when it's snowing? Do we see the greatness of God? Are the invisible attributes clearly seen? Are God's invisible attributes clearly seen to us? And I just want to add, we've only touched on two items. Two. Snow. Snowflakes and stars. There are so many more things we could discuss. So many. I mean, for instance, think about this. With the Earth, it spins 1,000 miles an hour. And it's tilted. It's amazing. It's tilted at the perfect angle. I believe they say 23.6 degrees, something like that. It actually fluctuates between 22 and 26. It has a little bit of a wobble. But you know what that wobble does? It keeps it in perfect orbit. I found that was very interesting. But it's angled just enough to where we get four seasons. As if it was straight, and it just spun at 1,000 miles an hour and orbited the sun, you'd be frozen on both ends, and it'd be warm in the middle. And no, it's amazing how God created it. At that perfect tilt, that way, when it gets on one side of the sun, you have the southern hemisphere that's in the summer and spring. And then when it gets on the other side of the sun, guess what? We're in summer and spring, and they're in winter and fall. Whenever we think about these things, when we consider these things, what comes to mind? Does the greatness of God come to mind? Well, it should. Like I said, because hopefully it shows us His invisible attributes. And like I said at the very beginning, I'm literally scratching the surface. Scratching the surface on this. We don't have time to go into all the items that reveal the greatness of God. Like I said, it's His whole Bible. And it's everything we see. They're too numerous. So I guess you could say there is much for us to stop and consider. There's much for us to meditate upon how awesome our great God is. That's how it's revealed. We look for it. We think about it. We meditate upon it. We consider it. And we see God's greatness just through His physical creation. And that's all I'm really touching on today, is the physical things. But like I said, they lead to the spiritual, and we'll touch a little bit on that. But from what we see comes the second part. I mean, from how it's revealed, what is it that comes to our second part, which is what? What are we to learn from the greatness of God? That's what I was trying to get out. What are we to learn from the greatness of God? Let's go to Jeremiah 32. Jeremiah 32. Verse 17, just one verse. What is it that we are to learn? Jeremiah 32, verse 17. Ah, Lord God, behold, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. There is nothing too hard for you. We can see, just through God's creation, there is nothing God cannot do, with the exception of sin. Too many times people, and I'm not saying we do, but people in general, limit what God is able to do. They do. They limit what God is able to do. Just from his creation, even says in Romans 1, just from his creation, they should see that there is nothing too hard for God. Nothing at all that is too hard for God. What else should we learn? Isaiah 40. Isaiah 40, and we're going to start in verse 12. We'll read a few verses here. Isaiah 40, verse 12. Asks the question, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, measured heaven with a span, and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure? Who has? Who's weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who's done that? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has taught him? Who? No one has. And as we read, you'll see that. It says, with whom did he take counsel, and who instructed God? And who taught God in the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop in a bucket and are counted as a small dust on the balance. Look, God lifts up the isles as a very little thing. And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor its beasts sufficient for burnt offering. In other words, there's not enough offerings. Or not enough burnt offerings, and it says, Lebanon is not sufficient to burn. I mean, there's nothing that you can do that would compare to what God has done and he's able to do. He says, all nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted by him less than nothing and worthless. That's how they could be counted to God as nothing. But that isn't how God looks at it. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare to him? The workman molds a graven image. The goldsmith overspreads it with gold, and the silversmith casts silver chains. Whosoever is too impoverished for such a contribution chooses a tree that will not rot. He seeks for himself a skillful workman to prepare a carved image that will not totter. Trying to, if you will, carve an image of what God is like. You can't do that. There's no possible way. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is God who sits above the circle of the earth. And its inhabitants are like grasshoppers who stretch out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. God brings the princes to nothing, and he makes the judges, he says, of the earth useless. Scarcely shall they be planted, scarcely shall they be sown, scarcely shall they take stock or root in the earth. When he will also blow upon them, they will wither, and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. There is nothing to God. To whom then will you liken me? Or to whom shall I be equal, says God, says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things, who brings out their hosts by number. He calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. He says, not one is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord? It's not. You can see it. He says, and my just claim is passed over by God. Have you not known, have you not heard, the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary, nor there is no searching of his understanding. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases their strength. There is nothing God cannot do. We already said that. But from this, what we just read, we can see that God, through his greatness, that God knows everything. God knows everything. In verse 26, we read how God knows all the hosts by name. All the hosts by name. What did we just say? There could be a possibility of 10 trillion galaxies. 1 septillion stars. And he knows them all by name. Does this not cause us to have a deep awe and respect for God? In verse 12, as when we began, the question was asked, who has measured? Who's been able to measure the waters in the hollow of your hand? And who's been able to measure the heavens and know the amount of the dust of the earth? Nobody. except God? That's the answer. That's why he began with that particular question. So with this knowledge, what kind of awe and respect should this garner for everyone on this earth, and especially us? It should garner a healthy respect for what God is capable of doing, and a realization that God knows everything that goes on in his universe, because it is his creation. He knows everything. You can go to Matthew 10 and you can read about in verses 29 through 30 where he says he even knows the number of hairs that are on your head. He even says, and I'll quote, "Are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin? And not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will." God even knows into the smallest detail if a small sparrow dies. That roadkill on the side of the road, God knows. He keeps track of all that. Why? It's his creation. It's his. God knows everything, and he keeps record of all things. Nothing gets past him. Nothing. If you can name 1 septillion stars and know them all by name, nothing gets past you. Nothing at all. Nothing is hidden from his sight. You know, all of this shows us what? It shows us God's deep care and concern about, first of all, his creation. And what is the pinnacle of his creation? Us. And who did he put in? Who did he put to give dominion over all of his creation? Us. That just shows us God's care and concern and love, not only for his creation that we see and we get to enjoy, that he has given to us, but his care, concern, and love for us. Even though he is so much, so his superiority is so much beyond what we can even imagine. But it comes then to beg the question that we were going to look at. How, what, and why? Why does it matter? Why does it matter? That's the last component that we'll look at today regarding understanding God's greatness. What does understanding these amazing things about God do for you or me? What does reflecting on what God is capable of doing spur in my and in your mind? Does it spur an awe? Does it spur respect for who God is and what he's capable of? Does it spur an assurance of care and concern for us? An assurance of his love for us and all mankind as his creation as a whole? Is that what it spurs? Does it spur those types of mind, those thinkings in your mind? Well, it should, because that's what matters. That's why it matters. And I'll preface what we're getting ready to talk about by saying this. Who God is and what he's capable of doing doesn't matter, and I want to add this, to most of the rest of the world. It just doesn't. Most of the rest of the world has been, as we know, has been deceived, and many don't credit God with creating. And that's what Paul was bringing out in Romans 1. He says, and you'll be held accountable for that, because my invisible attributes are clearly seen for the things I've created. Even my nature is seen. You know, many people don't credit God with being great at all. Too many, unfortunately, feel like, well, they've been deceived to think he doesn't exist, or that he's weak, or that he doesn't care, or that he's cruel. They don't believe that God knows what's going on, and they don't believe that God sees their every action, and that all people have to give an account to their Creator one day, each and every one of us. And we know why, because Satan's done a great job deceiving much of mankind. So many. But he's deceived them into thinking, and there's going to be many more as time goes on, that they're going to be this type of thinking, that certain things aren't true, or they're not relevant. And from this deception, people don't believe that God exists, or they don't have a healthy respect for God or an awe for God at all. And they believe that the earth and the universe just came to be. When you start even looking at the snowflake, and you even look at the stars, you even look at what we just, like the eye, for one, how can anybody say that it just happened? It just happened. And as they say, we're just a cog in the wheel. But we know these things aren't true, don't we? Why? Because God has revealed these things to us. He has revealed them to us, and then we're held responsible for that. Our feet are held to the fire for what we know. And us, of all people, should see and begin to understand and grow in the knowledge of what God is all about. We must understand what God is capable of doing and what He is trying and continually striving to show us. Always. And we, especially those who have committed their lives to God and received His Spirit, should be encouraged and comforted by His creation. His very greatness that surrounds us. If we don't have a healthy respect of who God is and what He's capable of doing, we'll not be able to continue growing. We won't. We won't continue growing in our understanding of Him. That's what happened with Israel many, many times. What happened whenever God did all the plagues that had happened? Whoa! And did they believe God would deliver them? I think they did, because of everything that had happened. They had to believe that they were going to leave Egypt because they plundered the Egyptians prior to them leaving. But it didn't last long because they failed to consider and understand fully how great their God was, or how great their God is. If we don't take the time to consider our great God, we begin to, if you will, when we don't have that in the forefront of our mind, who He is and what He can do and what He's all about can begin to fade from our minds. And we can then begin to get caught up in the rhetoric of society. It happens. I've seen it happen. The same society that wants nothing to do with the God of all creation, the God of the universe. In Hosea 4:6, we're told, "For lack of knowledge, my people are destroyed." We can't allow that to happen. We have knowledge. God has granted us the understanding. He's granted us the understanding of what he's about. I mean, and we're talking, like I said, these are basic blocks, or should be, in the life of a Christian. We must continue striving to learn and grow and understand God. And like I said, and one aspect of that to help us continue forward is consider God's greatness. Consider God's greatness. Because as it says in Jeremiah 9:6, as God told Jeremiah, He says, "You are dwelling in the midst of deceit." We all dwell in the midst of deceit. And through this deceit, the world refuses to know God. Something we must never allow. We must not allow the knowledge of God to fade in our minds. Through God's greatness, we should be reminded of what God is all about and what He is doing in and through you and me. What His ultimate plan is. Why His creation even exists. Proverbs 1. Pick up the pace. I still got 6 pages of notes up here. I'm joking, I don't. Didn't want to get anybody excited. Proverbs 1, verse 7. "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise that wisdom and instruction." We can never despise that. The things that God is showing us, we must take that to heart. Proverbs 9, verse 10. "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." Our growth begins with the fear of God. Those of us who are learning, I might say that even our children, those who are learning, the young ones that are learning, those God is calling now, this is where they begin. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord, understanding His greatness. And those of us who have made the commitment with God, this is how we retain and continue growing. It's how we continue forward. For those of us who have been given the insight, those of us who have been shown the mysteries that befuddle the world, God expects something of us. He expects something of us. Do you know what God expects of us? And do you know why God expects something of us? Because we are the called and chosen by the very great God of the universe. We are, I might, you might put this, I'll put this in quotes, the microcosm. We are the microcosm. We are human beings encapsulating in miniature the characteristic qualities or features of something larger. I guess you could say we are encapsulating the macroism, which would be God Himself and all that He is about, as much as possible as can happen on a human level. Psalm 8. I've got just about three more passages here that we'll turn to. Psalm 8. Actually, four. Psalm 8 and verse 1. Psalm 8 and verse 1. Our Lord, O Lord, our Lord. This is from a Psalm of David. How excellent is your name in all the earth, you who set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and infants you have ordained strength. Because of your enemies that may silence the avenger, the enemy and the avenger. When I consider your heavens and the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? He says, for you have made him a little lower than the angels, and yet you have crowned him with glory and honor, and you have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands, and you have put all things under his feet. God has granted you and me the understanding of who he is. And when David, and he did with David as well, and when David would look at just the creation, David says, what is man? Who am I that you are mindful of me? Who am I that you have made me a little lower than the angels and you have crowned me with glory and honor? Who am I that you have made me to have dominion over the works of your hands? Who am I? Who am I that you have put all things under my feet? You know, there in Hebrews 2, verses 5 through 9, it talks about that. We believe it's Paul that wrote the book of Hebrews, but he says these things have not yet been fully done. Actually, let's go to, I do want to go there. So we got an extra passage. You're going to go to Hebrews 2. Hebrews 2. I think it'll help explain what I'm saying. Hebrews 2 and verse 5. This is interesting right here in verse 5 because it says, for God has not put the world to come of which we speak in subjection to angels. It isn't going to be given to the angels. He says, but one testified in a certain place, and this was David in Psalm 8. What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you take care of him? You made him a little lower than the angels, yet you crowned him with glory and honor, and you set over his works, set over the works of your hands. You have set him over the works of your hands, and you have put all things in subjection under his feet. For in that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him. But now we do not yet see all the things put under him. It has yet to fully transpire. When will it happen? At the revealing of the sons of men. The revealing of the sons of God, I should say, not the sons of men. The revealing of the sons of God. What's interesting is God wants us to become like him. We have been called to what God is, greatness. We've been called to greatness, and through this calling, God has revealed to us his mind, which he's striving to form in us. And he's shown us his plan, which we and all the inhabitants of the earth are part of that plan. How amazing is that? And now God says that you know this, and now you've said that you're going to live this way of life, and you understand who I am, and you've, if you will, given your life over to me, I want you to portray the very greatness that God is, that He is, that I have called you to. That's what He wants us to do. Psalm 145. This actually proves what I just said. Psalm 145. Psalm 145, verse. Let's see. Start verse 3. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. His greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall praise your works. This is a Psalm of David as well. One generation shall praise your works to another. It shall be passed on to your children and to your children's children, and shall declare your mighty acts. I will meditate on the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works. Men shall speak of the might of your awesome acts, and I will declare your greatness. They shall utter the memory of your great goodness and shall sing of your righteousness. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion, slow to anger and great in mercy. The Lord is good to all, and his tender mercies are over all his works. All your works shall praise you, O Lord. And here's where is where becomes, if you will, what God has called us to do. And your saints, what are we? We're the saints of the Most High. We're the elect. God is one day going to make us eternal saints, if you will. But now, he says, your saints shall bless you. They shall speak of the glory of your kingdom and talk of your power, to make known to the sons of men his mighty acts and the glorious majesty of his kingdom. This is what we've been tasked to do today. Those of us who have been called to greatness, no, we have not received it as of yet, as we read in Hebrews 2. But we've been called to be the recipients and then to be the examples of who God is and what he is doing. We are to bless our Father in heaven, it says here. We are to speak of the glory of his coming kingdom, and we are to talk of his power. We are to make known to the sons of men his mighty acts and the glorious majesty of his kingdom, now and in the future to come. We are to talk, proclaim, and live and make known the greatness of our God. We are to be the examples of who God is, encapsulating, as I said, in miniature, the characteristic qualities of, or features of our great God, our great and loving God. It's beyond comprehension. This is why we must stop and we must consider even the little things of God's creation, because they reveal and they remind us. They reveal and remind to us something so much bigger. So much bigger. They help, as I said at the beginning, they help recalibrate our minds. They help recalibrate us to what is important, to what matters. And it helps keep us, if you will, focused on the tasks that we've been given. In 1 Corinthians 13, Paul mentions, and this is in the love chapter. I encourage you to, it's amazing how it, why he put that, or God inspired it to be put where he had, or where it's put in 1 Corinthians 13. Actually, let's go there. Let's close with that. 1 Corinthians 13. Verse 9 says, for we know in part and we prophesy in part. We know it, we don't fully know it. We know in part and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, what we have been called to, what God has asked us to portray, yes, are we going to do it perfectly? No. But we have been given God's Spirit as a guide. He says, but when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away, will be made whole and complete. He says, when I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. And that's what's going to happen. He says, for now we see in a mirror. We see these things dimly. We see these things dimly. But he says, but then face to face, now I know in part, but one day I will know fully. I will know fully. Today we see in a mirror dimly what it is that we are being called to, but one day face to face with the great God and creator of the universe. This is what God has called you, and he has called me to, his greatness. And I would encourage all of us to consider it.